You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm sorry it's been a while since I've had something for you, but it's been quite a year for various reasons that I'm not going to go into now. But the next few episodes were recorded on a road trip up the East Coast. I'm trying to get a bit further afield for you guys, as I'm aware that the podcast has been largely south and east focused to date. So this trip took me to Lincolnshire and then all the way up to southeast Scotland, visiting farms in the borders, as well as going along to the famous Highland Show, which was such a good day. I had a really grand time and I hope you enjoy the results. So first up is the leg to Lincolnshire, visiting flower grower, Farmers Weekly columnist and yes, Nuffield scholar, they get about, Matthew Naylor. I'm about 10 minutes off first stop, which is with Matt Naylor, who grows more flowers than I think I can possibly imagine. It says on the website, certainly, and he's quoted many times, it's about 50 million. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing Matt. He's a real character, so at least it comes across that way from Farmers Weekly. So to actually meet him face to face is quite exciting. I have to say, if I do another one of these road trips, I'm going to have to invite someone along. I've been rabbiting away to myself. And I like my own company, don't get me wrong. But if anyone wants to join me on a future Meet the Farmers road trip, please do get in touch. Lincolnshire is, well, very flat, I suppose. It's the obvious way of describing it, but it really is, even having come from Essex. Huge fields, growing a vast range of different things, which, again, my first guest, Matt, proves you can pretty much grow anything here. I eventually got to Naylor Flowers, which is a very busy place, and when I arrived at Matt's house, he and several others were preparing for an event taking place the day after, which gave me a flavour of how his life runs there. But I managed to sit down with him to try and understand his life in Lincolnshire a little better. In the usual way on Meet the Farmers, we began by talking about his business.
We're quite unusual in terms of arable farming, I suppose, because people always say, how many acres do you have when you talk to a farmer? And that just is such a meaningless statistic to me, because we're really a people business. We're producing cut flowers, which are cropped and harvested and arranged by hand for supermarkets. So that's really what we're about. And it's grown.
And you're selling to Aldi, Waitrose,
Aldi,
and the Co-op?
That's exactly right, yeah. I suppose we're quite lucky in that we've got good relationships with supermarkets that have great values that sit quite well with our own. So we're trying to broaden our range of cut flowers and all the usual challenges of working in harmony with the environment and trying to upskill jobs and give people better, more fulfilling jobs and delight customers with longer vase life and all the usual challenges.
But this farm hasn't always been about flowers. If you go back to before you started in the business, say, what did it look like then?
Well, as we ride round in a little while, you'll see that this area used to grow, you'd call it market gardening almost, yeah, in most people's language. Lots of small family farms producing vegetables, cut flowers, salad crops, which would be loaded off to the wholesale markets. And so we were one of those. My great-grandfather started in a council holding. His son, my grandfather, bought 4 acres of land in 1948. And so when I joined the business a good few years ago now, we were farming 120 acres and growing a mix of, no livestock, but there was wheat, potatoes, sugar beet, a little bit of white cabbage and some daffodil bulbs. So it was quite diverse and it was all family labour with a couple of ladies from the village who used to come and help us.
What is the state of the flower industry today, specifically perhaps comparing the Dutch model with the British model over here?
That's interesting. The Dutch tend to be very intensive. They invest lots of money and everybody is a specialist. So you're either a specialist in Gerbera or Alströmeria or Freesia, and you have state-of-the-art facilities which produce the highest quality. And a lot of the stuff then goes into a big clearinghouse like Aldsmere. And that will then get distributed to all corners of the world. In the UK, it's very difficult to be a specialist in one crop because we don't have that one central market like they have. So if you're supplying a supermarket, as we are with JZ, the company that we work with, it means that you have to grow a variety of things to keep you working all year round and to keep that relationship. So that would be the fundamental difference. And I think perhaps compared with Holland, for all manner of reasons, the UK is not as heavily invested.
You've invested quite a bit of capital in the business in the last few years, including a workers' village.
Well, there's a story.
Tell me about that.
I think, I mean, the whole Brexit, when we, my views on leaving the European Union are not a secret. I'm yet to be convinced that it's a great thing for everybody, but we sprung into action and tried several different things because a lot of the people who are harvesting flowers with us were born in Eastern Europe and have settled here. So we were very worried about the impact that it would have on them, whether they would be able to stay. So one thing that we put in for planning consent to accommodate 100 people on the farm. We also started a labour agency. We started conversations with people at Hops, Concordia. We looked at bringing in people from agricultural colleges or just any college in summer holidays. So we really put a lot of thought in. But the planning consent didn't get granted. There is a lot of ill feeling in this area towards the changes that have come about with different Eastern European people, which is very, very sad. I mean, we've built our business with these people. We think the world of them and admire them.
What was the result in Lincolnshire in terms of percentage of people?
Embarrassing. 70, wow. High 70% in favour of leaving in our local area. Yeah, and I'm not...
This is not where I thought this conversation was going.
No, nor me.
Let's run with it.
I'm a bit sensitive around it because I life's been pretty good to me. You know, I had a hard... the start of my life was pretty hard, but life's very good to me now. And the whole point of capitalism and democracy is that it challenges people and that it shares things around. And so, I'm pretty happy to have my position challenged because that's how other people go on to make lives in the same way that I have. So I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
But I will defend myself, of course.
Talking about challenging, let's turn to your Farmers Weekly column, which... How long have you been writing? When did that begin and how did that begin?
15 years. When Jane King came in and the magazine went through a rebrand and they wanted to bring in some younger writers. I was younger then. I'd been writing for a local publication, so it was kind of on the back of that. I'd been the Farmers Weekly Young Farmer of the Year just before that, and so I knew the people, and that kind of started on a fairly wide rota.
And where do you get your inspiration from? Where does it come from? Do you know what you're going to write about when you sit down? What you're going to write or
No, that's interesting because I've got a piece to write by this Thursday and I was just chatting to Ian Piggott, my mate, this morning about what we were going to write about. It's good when you're busy. I think it encourages you to listen to people and to get busy because it's nice. And the other brilliant thing about doing it is when you write things, you get challenged.
Absolutely.
And that refines what you think. So it stops you getting fixed opinions about things that are wrong.
I like the fact you try and get new words in as well.
That's always my game.
It's always good to look out for those.
That's always my game.
Now, again, on that basis of challenging, and you mentioned in your interview with Will Evans for Rock and Roll Farming, you said something that particularly grabbed me, which is that the role of the opinion writer is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Who are the afflicted and the comfortable today, in your opinion?
My opinion, I'm a bit of a millennial in spirit in my shopping habits and in the way I go about things. I really identify with that generation. I think it's very hard for people who want to get into agriculture now. Really hard. I think it's very hard for young people to buy houses. You know, if you come from a great background and went to public school and your parents have got plenty of money, it's not a problem to buy a house. But so I suppose the poorer your background, then the harder that is. We have had a lot of support for people over the years, and they've only, you know, responded to what was there. But I do feel that they've been quite lucky. And I think that although there's nothing worse than people who are ingracious, you know, when they've got a good hand of cards. And that's how I feel about some baby boomers, what I would term Daily Mail mentality. So I think it's those kind of people who have got it good but want it better. I think they're the people that I find, you know, the ones who deserve to be challenged. Mm. And although I've written once, to my cost, about young farmers saying they shouldn't expect any special handouts, it wasn't. It was just a matter of preparing them for what the world's like. Yeah. Because there seemed to be more and more of a chorus of young people asking for handouts like the previous generation had, when what they should have been asking for is an end to privilege, because that would benefit them, was my theory.
And that matter of diversity is very important to you on from various perspectives, and you're actually the activist in this regard as well.
Oh, I love the word activist. That's one that we use. I do think that because we do a lot of work. When we say, as the farming community, we say we've got to encourage new entrants, we've got to reconnect with the consumer. I don't dispute that. But what a lot of people mean by that is propaganda. We've got to make the consumer understand us. I'm a man who drives a Discovery and lives in a big house, and the consumer has to accept the way that I produce things because glyphosate is vital, or whatever campaign we're pushing. And I think that's a bit unfair, because connecting with the consumer means understanding their position. Some people might want to buy high welfare meat, but for economic reasons it's not on their radar. Well, that's, we need to listen to that. We mustn't moralise. And I think that we probably have left them behind. And when you look at the ethnic diversity in the UK, there are a large percentage of the population from black, Asian, minority ethnic groups who don't get represented in agriculture at all. In the food industry, where you think about the amazing cuisine that we have in this country, influenced by obviously Indian, Chinese food, but even Lebanese food or Italian food. Mm. I mean, that's really amazing. But you don't see those people. They come to the UK to start food businesses, but not to start farming businesses.
So actually, this is going far beyond a sort of rural-urban divide. The issue is far more complicated in terms of lots of little divisions in different places and different people and people accepting other people.
Yeah, it's just something that, I mean, I'm not, it's just something that really interests me. Yeah. As I've got older and more grateful for my life, I think that then you start to look at other people and think, well, is this, you know, is this right? Is society right, how this stuff's distributed? And are we walking the walk when it comes to engaging with the public? And, you know, you can't, when people are using food banks, you can't look them in the eye and say British farmers need more money for what they produce, because that just, there's something there, there's something broken, isn't there? Mm-hmm.
Something that afflicts both the consumers, those people, and the farmers, in fact all of us, is the issue of mental health, which is something that I'm trying to spearhead at the moment. I am, dear listeners, I'm running a half marathon, which I would love if you, with hashtag farmer mental health in mind, if you could visit my Just Giving page, go on Just Giving, a search for Ben Eagle, any pennies at all would be wonderful for that. I've got 9 weeks to go, I'm terrified.
Well done.
But anyway, so mental health is something that affects us all.
Do you know, that's a really interesting point, because what do you mean, when you think of mental health, what do you mean by that? Because I have theories about this as well.
Yeah. I was leading on to your yoga and sort of shutting off, but I think mental health is something that you only truly value once you've recognised and gone through a period when you actually notice it. You notice you're going through periods of poor mental health.
Yeah.
It's something that you completely take for granted. Poor mental health is all about being unable to do the things that you see as normal in your mind before. Good mental health is about being your own person. Good mental health is about being able to hope for something, to think about improving your situation. So it's a very complicated thing, but it's something that tough nut image, it goes against all that.
Something
that we have, that macho culture that we have in farming.
I mean, I agree that it's a massive issue. But I think that when we say mental health, what we're doing is we're skirting around the subject of depression.
Mm, absolutely.
And I've had depression. I think that actually there's a lot of things about life that are quite depressing. So I don't think it's wrong to deal with that. But I reckon the other side of mental health, which is egotism, people who are driven by massive, who have to keep acquiring land. Yeah. Having a Range Rover, I mean, I have a car with a personalised number plate, and I accept the twatishness of that behaviour.
Drove behind it while I was coming in.
Yeah, and that is a...
Nothing wrong with it.
Well, no, there isn't anything wrong with it, but it's a kind of a... It isn't necessary. It is a kind of... It's not mentally healthy. I think working too many hours and not going home, if you have children, not going home to see your children, prioritising things, I think that's poor mental health.
So not having balance.
Yes. So I think that when you say this person is depressed, they're mentally unhealthy, but I'm a massive egotist with narcissistic tendencies who farms 5,000 acres and will crush anyone in their path, and there are people like that in agriculture who just want a bigger and bigger combine, is that mentally robust? Is that balanced? Do they look back on their deathbed and think, well, I got that one right? So I think there's a debate to be had. But within it, I think that unfortunately, we hold up the image of a farmer as being a very particular kind of character in the UK and Western Europe. If you go to Africa, a farmer might be a woman or it might be somebody completely different. Yeah. But here, it's a man, isn't it? It might be, and so he's on a quad bike and he's a, he's doing this, or he's a man on a combine. But the idea of getting a more diversity and kind of giving people more freedom to be themselves with less expectation of what's right and wrong and what's mentally healthy and what isn't, I think that's something that would really liberate food production and get more people involved, make more people feel engaged.
So in terms of switching off and cutting away from, you live a very busy life, quite a stressful life at times.
Occasionally.
Is that why you practice yoga? Or does the yoga come despite all that, something that you enjoy?
Well, I'm not very good at team sports. I was never very good at team sports. I'm super competitive. and I'm not a great team player. I say that with humility, but I'm not. So I kind of wanted a physical activity that wasn't that. And I think that when you think, if like me, you like a glass of wine with your dinner and enjoy your dinner, it's easy to, you get to an age when you start to get fatter. So you want to find ways of losing weight. But if you're not careful, you replace the stimulant of a gin and tonic when you get in for the stimulant of endorphins and going for a run. And that also has a crashing. So your highs and lows. And you can't live your life on highs. I don't know, I didn't realise this at the time, but I just wanted to do, some sort of physical activity that I could do as I got older. My grandma, who's 90 and as fit as a flea and drives and goes to salsa classes and went up the Amazon last year, has done yoga since I was a little boy. So I suppose that
must
she's
be something
my role
in it.
Model. Yeah, yeah, you'd say so, wouldn't you?
Let's turn to the Oxford Farming Conference. How do you make sure that the conference remains relevant year on year and sufficiently challenges farmers' thinking?
That's the funny thing, isn't it? Because the conference has been going for 80 years. And like anything that's old, it does date. It's really hard to keep it fresh. I'm a member of Spalding Gentlemen's Society, which when it started in the 1700s was like a learned society. It newspapers, pre-books, pre the division of science into biology and chemistry. And, it was just, there was just knowledge and these people used to get together to learn the latest thing. And now, over the years, because they got less, it's turned into a museum and an antiquarian society. So it does happen. And So it's a good question with Oxford, because our remit is to challenge, inform and inspire. And so, yeah, we said the other day when we were talking about the coming programme, we want to surprise people. We want them to hear something that they weren't expecting to hear. But the good thing about being a director is it makes you look broadly to bring things back. And of course it's hard because there's a lot of smart people. We have the internet now.
Yeah.
You know, years ago, when there was only Oxford Farming Conference, that was what you did. You used to have to get there. I mean, in the 1920s, people didn't drive there as quickly in a car as we do now. It was just a completely different age. Whereas now you can find out a lot on the internet. So we're having to engage and embrace that and the way that we disseminate information. But you're right, the skill as a council is to get speakers that are not on the circuit. Oh, and I mean, farming is... I was sitting in front of an oak table and I could bang my head on it when we say this, but with so many clichés, so many things repeated, and without really thinking about them, just because it's what we say. So, no, last year, it was great. James Wong was brilliant at the conference last year. Eve Torrow-Paul was phenomenal. I would urge anybody to go onto the YouTube channel and watch that presentation because she was brilliant. And, you know, just such good company in real life. But the presentation encapsulates it all.
Can you tell us anything about OFC 2019?
Yes, we're working on it at the moment. We have got some speakers booked, and there's always a lot of shuffling around with MPs and people coming internationally. But our theme is World of Opportunity, and we'll be very close to trade negotiations then. We'll have a clearer idea. And so, yeah, exactly. As much as anything, I mean, you know, I think George Monbiot summed it up when he said that we'll be kicked out of the EU like a drunk being kicked out of pub at closing time. And it was a great line, and I just, every time, I think it sums it up for me. But I hope I'm wrong. I'd be much better off if I am wrong. So we will see, won't we? But that's what we're gearing up for, to get great international speakers from all these countries who perhaps the EU might have prevented us from buying things from.
A few big questions now. Firstly, should British farming aim for big and specialised or small and mixed?
Oh, big and specialised. I don't actually think that size matters. I don't think it's about scale. I think scale appropriate is important. I would say that what we ought to be is market driven. So I think that even now, I think that this DEFRA policy is a bit of a red herring, because everybody is saying, just tell us what to do and how much you're going to pay us and we'll do it. Well, that's, the government isn't a market. You don't want a government deciding stuff. The politicians change every 5 minutes if you go to a business. So I think that people need to get back in touch with their consumer, because it's not the 1970s. We're not growing crops for intervention at fixed prices. And the reality is, we're going to have Australian meat coming in here, which is going to turn meat production in this country on its head. We're probably going to have American products, chlorinated chicken or chicken. It won't be cruel to them, because I don't think there's anything wrong with it. Canadian wheat, you know, all of those old relationships with the empire. And that was always in the past stuff coming in. So I think we've just got to know who our consumer is.
What does public money for public goods mean to you?
Do you want me to be controversial, or shall I just shut up and say something meaningless? Is this a little bit landowners lobbying to get money for something? Is it just that? Tell us what to do and we'll do it. Because my belief is that if you own land and you're sending water, if rainwater lands on it and leaves your farm with phosphates or nitrates in, that's not something you should be paid to prevent. That's something you shouldn't be allowed to do. We don't pay people to stay within the speed limit. I know that's fairly controversial against in the current climate, but I just think that public goods should be kind of part of what we do. That's sort of in the same way that we don't beat one another up in the street and we get to work on time and we adhere to the laws. I just think, you drive that legally. Personally, I'd like to see a lot more state-owned land, I think. Human beings don't live very long in the, you know, in terms of a planet's life. And it, I don't know, I don't think private ownership of land actually really gives long-term thinking in the right way. We don't live as long as a tree, really, do we? I mean, I would say that you would need a national vehicle, so you would, you know, in the same way that you have the National Trust. I think that the... I don't know, I mean, this isn't a policy. I'm not standing as a politician, right. But I look at it and I think there is a lot of land that's owned by the Crown, by the Church, by the National Trust, by the Forestry Commission. I think that there's probably something there. We need to have some areas that are for production. And I think that that land really is it's almost an industrial land round here. It's almost an industrial resource because we're producing things intensively. We need it for food. But when you get onto hill farms, which are huge catchments for rainwater and the water's feeding huge towns, then that's a lot more complicated.
Because this is one of the big themes when I'm up north the next few days. I want to be talking about this quite a bit. And of course, in Scotland, they've had a whole host of land reform going through. Scotland's a very different case to England, but can you see a similar sort of basis of land reform happening down here at any point?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a businessman at heart. I just respond to what the circumstances are. I mean, that's why I'm not a politician. Things happen and I just make the best of that. So if it changes, then I'll change my business model. I do appreciate that everything that's done, every government change or every policy change has a human impact, and sometimes they're not very nice. But that's not an argument for never changing anything, because at the moment, you know, it's not ideal.
And finally, it relates to your Nuffield, Brown Britannia. Do we know what that is yet? Are we in a position where we can go out to the rest of the world and sell ourselves with Brown Britannia?
Yeah.
And do we? I mean, with several things, you've been a bit ahead of the game. But you did. Oh, was that 2007?
I think it was earlier. I was
five.
Yeah, it was early. It was early 2000s. Yeah. I mean, we were joking about this the other day because Ben was teasing me because I keep going on about it. But I did a farming podcast 10 years ago, and it was just too early to get anything going. Okay. Yeah, and the British brand. What I looked at round about start of the millennium was the this middle ground between. I was saying, well, if I can't be a huge 5,000 acre farmer with combines and I don't want to wear a penny on a market stall, what is there for me in the middle? And it seemed to fall back to branding and having a position within the market. And we were, you know, exporting daffodils in a small way then, and, you know, there's a lot more. With JZ, who we work with on our site, are huge exporters of daffodils. We're exporting tens of millions of pounds worth of daffodils from the UK each year. But yeah, we weren't then. That was something that really interested me. But is it... I think that there are rich people in China who want to buy very expensive Scotch whisky. They want to buy posh wine from Berry Brothers. The shortbread in tins with Union Jacks on in Tokyo Airport, which Boris Johnson always holds up as the panacea for British agriculture, just cheeses me off because it makes me think he's never left an airport in one of those countries. And I think, well, that's just nonsense. So in terms of actual commodity production, Michael Gove seems to think that we'll be able to sell premium meat on our welfare standards. I'm not sure. It looks like there are markets in the rest of the world for things that we don't eat, like chicken hearts and chicken feet and pig's trotters. Yeah, I suppose. But I don't know. We have very high working standards, and you can't expect a hard-working person in Indonesia on a very low wage to pay a lot of money for food that was produced by someone earning £8 an hour. That's not how the global economy works, whatever we might wish. So I think it's going to be difficult for us. Water finds its own level and we're a rich economy. So I think it'll be difficult.
Should we look at some flowers?
Yeah, let's have a ride round.
I left the... There was no culture for further education, really, in our family, so I left the grammar school when I was 15 to come and work on the family farm, because that was what you did. Yeah. And I just was ambitious. I wanted more.
There was the seed of something there, and you thought, let's take this.
So we thought, well, what else could we grow? But don't think I didn't try a billion things. I mean, I did. I went to did a project with looking at growing ethnic vegetables for ethnic communities. I mean, that was a long while ago, going around Birmingham and looking at what could we grow. What were different communities eating that we hadn't thought to produce? So I did that. I did... We spent a while where I really made, I suppose, my first proper profit was packing potatoes from Israel and that had weed peanuts in them to stop the sort of peanut allergy problems. And we ended up packing all of Agrexco's food service salad potatoes. What? So that became quite a big business. And it finished, exchange rate with the shekel, Agrexco went bankrupt. I mean, it was a bit, it all went wrong for all kinds of reasons, and cheaper, you know, potatoes from elsewhere in the world. But it was a, it gave me a bit of a an education into employing people. Yeah. What else did I do? I mean, a billion things. We had a trial ground in partnership with a Kenyan company. We've done... Yeah, I mean, I went round the block. The mail order daffodil bulbs with a promo with the NFU. Yeah, it's not. I did a lot of things. This is a crop of ornamental brassica. Yeah, like a cabbage that you put in bouquets.
So this is your later harvesting.
Yeah, and this will be ready in... As you can imagine, brassicas are something that are ready in the winter. And that's grown at a density of something like 100 plants to the square metre. We'd be the biggest producer of them in the UK. A bit of a unique thing that we do is produce them outdoors. So, that's... With us, it's all about trying to do things a bit more cost-effectively than other people. I like.
So we've got some sunflowers on one side.
Yes, and sunflowers on the other side.
And sunflowers on the other side.
Drilling every week, more or less. Right from the 1st of March right till the 1st of July. So this is planting number one. And we're trying to get sunflowers every single day, apart from Sundays and Saturday afternoons. We don't like flowers then. So.
And they're drilled very close together.
Really close. Yeah, really close. And that's partly to stop the stems getting too thick.
Yeah.
You see, there's different varieties. Okay. So we're growing them for different reasons. We have Japanese seed, we have Israeli seed, we have working with breeders from all over to get that continuity.
And how does the ordering system work? Do you get in the mornings an order list, which is then picked to order, or how does that work?
Well, supermarkets, yeah, the supermarket orders come. This sounds insane. You would never design a business this way. They come probably 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours before dispatch, and that's it. They can be a long way from your predicted level.
Yeah.
They aren't usually. There's a bit of levelling out, because a supermarket that has a lot of stores, if one order's a bit high, the other's a bit low. So we tend to, the programmes are pretty fair. And flowers like this, we'd leave them in cold store for 2 or 3 days without huge detriment. So if we have a hot day one day, you hope you won't have another hot day and another hot day, else you get far too many. That does happen.
How do you plan what you're going to plant? How many and how much?
This is a body of work which I do myself every year from probably August to October. I create the workbook for the 14 crops that we do. So that'll be tied to field choices, which fields we're renting, soil sampling, ordering seed, because among the 14 crops, in each one there's probably 12 different varieties of each thing, and of them we'll probably be drilling 8 different plantings. So you break it down into hundreds and hundreds of plots across... I don't actually know how many... I never no acreage, because as you can see, there's roadways and bits.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm guessing that we're somewhere around 250-300 hectares of cropped land now. But we'll be nudging, production this year will be nudging towards 70 million stems.
Where do you get your drive from?
Little man syndrome. I'm quite short. I've got a massive chip on my shoulder, you know, being bald and gay and short and stuff. It does, I don't know, you do get a bit bitter about it. You kind of, have you heard of Velvet Rage? It's wonderful. It's put by Alan Downs about how gay people just want to excel, to rub everyone's nose in it. That's a proper thing. So, yeah, I've got that and little man syndrome. I don't know what they call it, a bald. That too, I suppose. So that's part of it. But I do like, you know, I quite like, I suppose that I live quite well. I quite like having a bit of money in my pocket to do stuff. I do admit that it's a bit embarrassing, but it's sort of true. So this is our, two routes back to the car park. To get back, you've got the nature walk there, or you've got the concrete footpath. You take your choice.
I should just say, we've just pulled into, in my terms, this is the main yard, but what do you call this place?
This is the main site, so this is where we pack the flowers. So we have two satellite, we have four, but we have two main satellite farm yards, but this is where the flowers come back when they've been harvested. So we've got cold stuff, about 50,000 square feet of cold storage here, where we can stack things nice and high, and things are being made. So we partner, what we did a few years ago is partner with JZ Flowers, a very large packing distribution business from Hull, and they pack our products in these two front buildings, which they rent from us, and it works very successfully. It's a really good partnership.
Yeah, thank you so much. Anyway.
Pleasure.
I always say it's been fascinating when I've been around these places, but this is, it's such a complex place. Mm. And you've got so many people doing so many different things.
Yeah, in different languages, with different fields, on different tenancies. No, it's bizarre. But it's not how you design it.
Yeah.
The idea of buying this was that we'd eventually get a land in a block and that I'd be able to partner with the people who run this farm and rotate around to simplify matters, but I don't know if that'll work. Yeah. I've kind of got a bit more of a game plan.
Yeah.
I mean, the game plan was always first 50% of your career, accrue knowledge, accrue money. Second half of it, disseminate the knowledge, disseminate the money. You know, that's share the wealth. That's really the idea. And I think that at this, I mean, I'm just entering my 30th year of work, because I started at 15. But buying this house is kind of the pinnacle. I don't really need a bigger house now. I don't need a bigger car. I've kind of had all that I need there. I've travelled a lot. I love travelling. But I don't need any more. So now I can afford to make sure that everybody else gets the same benefits.
Brilliant.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
So that was the first stop on the road trip. Big thanks to Matt for hosting me and for letting me chat to him and look around his farm. Next up, I travelled north to visit my next guest, who is a dairy farmer and tomato grower called Jim Shanks, who farms in the Scottish Borders. He will feature in the next episode. If you enjoy this episode and would like to listen to previous episodes of Meet the Farmers, they're available anytime on thinkingcountry.com, or please do subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and spread the word. We're trying to grow the podcast, and it can only really be done with your help, so I'd really, really appreciate that. It would be great if you can join me next time on Meet the Farmers.